Okay, hello. I'll get this sucker rolling. This is Mark Schenker. You're tuned into the clinical teleconference from the Society of Addiction Psychology, and this is a monthly call. We've got a couple of more lined up for the rest of 2018 and beginning of 19, which I will tell you about at the end. Today we have Dr. Joe Troncalli talking to us about acceptance and commitment therapy in the addiction setting. Dr. Troncalli is board certified in family medicine and addiction medicine, and he's the medical director at the Retreat at Lancaster. And a couple of quick housekeeping things is, because I'm recording it, please be aware of anything that you discuss that might have some confidential implications. Please press the mute button, because otherwise we can hear everything that goes on. And in terms of sharing information, be very clear on the confidentiality aspect of it. So let's get this show on the road. Dr. Troncalli, it's all yours.
Thanks very much, Mark. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be with everybody. I want to say from the outset that it's been a pleasure to work with Mark over the
years.
And hello, everybody. We're getting a lot of people coming in on the line. So anyway, as you come in, we welcome you. And then, like I said, Mark's asking that you go ahead and push your mute button if you can. And then if there's questions, though, you're welcome, more than welcome, to break in at any time. I have no problem being interrupted. So please feel free to do that. Let me just begin by saying that I was introduced to acceptance and commitment therapy a number of years ago by a friend of mine who's a psychologist, and the reason that I adopted it was that it seemed to be the most helpful thing that I had found in working with patients with addiction. And let me back that up, because I'm sort of a two-trick pony. My biggest interest when I first started in addiction medicine about 20 or 25 years ago was like neurobiology and that sort of thing, because I always felt that people didn't understand the disease concept of addiction, in that there's definitely differences in people who have addiction in their brain and people who don't have addiction in their brain. And addiction, people with addiction are outnumbered by a factor of about 9 to 1 with people who don't have addiction. And so people with addiction are generally poorly understood. And especially when you get into outside of professional circles, what you see a lot of are people who really see addiction as a moral failure or weakness, or why can't you just stop and all that sort of stuff. So my early years in addiction medicine were actually me learning more about the neurobiology, and that's kind of how I got to that point. And then when I would work with patients, one of the things that I always felt like I lacked was a great tool for basically giving people a framework, especially in the context of acute treatment. Most of my work has been in treatment centers that are the Minnesota model type, 28-day type programs and that sort of thing. And so we only get the average length of stay with the people that I see is about 21 days, not counting them being in PHP or IOP. And so we only get a brief shot at people, and I really needed some sort of context in which to talk to people and give them a framework for where they were going to go with their addiction treatment. And that's where acceptance and commitment therapy seemed to help me and seemed to help my patients. So that's where I'm coming from. I just wanted to give you that background. So if you've got the handout, first I'm going to be using my slides, even though I know you can't see any slides, but I gave Mark my set of slides, and if you have those, that's what I'm going to be following along with. Now, the other handout by Russ Harris called Getting Unstuck in ACT, I'm going to refer to that a little bit later on in the talk. So let's start first with
Joe,
the slides.
Joe, let me interrupt. I did send out the slides. Everybody should have them. If you don't, shoot me a quick email, and I'll try to get them out to you, like, now. The email address is mschenker, M-S-C-H-E-N-K-E-R, at navpoint, N-A-V-P-O-I-N-T. All right, sorry about that.
Okay, very good. So the first slide is just a slide about what acceptance and commitment therapy is, or ACT. And basically, it's the third wave of cognitive behavioral therapy. I was talking to Mark about this earlier, but I'm from Alabama, and so things have to operate on simple principles for me based on my background. ACT is really not a substitute for 12-step recovery, and so I don't want anybody to think that I use ACT in lieu of either 12-step recovery or any other treatment modality for that matter. It's just something that I think, and I'll explain this later, I think there are a lot of people in the rooms of AA who are sort of get stuck in the rooms, and that's not meant in any way to be a bash on AA, because I've been involved with all of this stuff for a long time, and I have the highest respect for the use of 12-step recovery. It's just that some people go to meetings, but they're not able to sort of move past going to meetings and that sort of thing. The other thing I like about ACT is that you can teach it in increments to your staff or patients, and so you don't have to be at some special level of cognition or sophistication to really get the principles of ACT. And if you want to look further into ACT, if you go to the book, The Happiness Trap, or the website, www.actmindfully.com.au, which is Russ Harris's site, then you can get all the information that you want. But I'm going to my next slide. The ACT principles, in a nutshell, state that life is generally polarized by individuals into two choices. People generally either escape their feelings and move towards suffering. Now, this is not a conscious process. This is just what people learn how to do. They either escape their feelings and move towards suffering, or they accept their feelings and then they move towards their values. And then if you go to the next slide, then I talk about acceptance and commitment therapy and the limbic system. And this harkens back to what I was saying at the beginning of the talk. I'm a two-trick pony, and my one trick is the neurobiology. And if you study acceptance and commitment therapy, what you find out is that, or 12-step recovery for that matter, what you find out is that therapy and 12-step recovery are ways of calming the limbic system and keeping people sort of out of what we call their lizard brain. Just to give the quick and dirty on the limbic process and that sort of thing, the anterior cingulate gyrus is the beginning of the limbic system, and that's really where mood and those sorts of things reside. And then if you go further back into the limbic system, the ventral tegmental nucleus accumbens complex has to do with the pleasure center, and that's the part of the brain that we really believe is most dysregulated in people with addiction, in that dopamine is not able to be re-regulated in people who have developed addiction. Now, the nucleus accumbens, anterior cingulate gyrus, again, which we associate highly nowadays with bipolar disorder, autism, those sorts of things. The nucleus accumbens, ventral tegmental nucleus complex, which we associate with addiction, the hippocampus, which we associate with memory, and the amygdala, which we associate with trauma and fear, are all very closely associated with each other, and they basically create the limbic system, and this is the part of the brain that's dysregulated for people who suffer with addiction. And if you go to the next slide, it talks about the 6 F's, which in the limbic system have to do with fight, flight, feeding, fear, freezing, and reproduction. And the the deal with that is that when we see people who are emotionally dysregulated, either because of their addiction or as a part of their addiction, what we're trying to do ultimately is to keep people out of that automatic sort of behavior. And we're going to talk about how ACT deals with that, just as some other therapies do. And so if you look more deeply into ACT, I'm going to the next slide, flight and escape is not just from danger. We really escape from our feelings with the same abandon that we use to escape physical danger. Certain thoughts, feelings, or emotions are just as bad for people as you would take an overt physical threat. And so when you have overt physical threats, we know pretty much what to do. We figure out ways to escape, or we figure out ways to deal with it, or we just run away. Emotional problems, unfortunately, are more pervasive for most people, and they continue to reinforce patterns that create escape mechanisms, but there's really no way to break the cycle of escape if you're not willing to make some significant changes in the way that you deal with your feelings. And so the escape, as we'll find out if we talk more about this acceptance and commitment stuff, is that escape chronically leads to suffering, and that there are particular types of escape mechanisms that people use and eventually self-destruct with those escape mechanisms. And so the next slide talks about, according to Harris, people do the escape by getting themselves into, number one, unworkable actions and avoiding solutions. So, again, it's the old thing that they talk about in the rooms of AA, where insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. The second thing that Harris talks about is his concept of fusion, which is different than family systems therapy concept of fusion. What he talks about is the projection of one's thoughts that become judgments or rules that really have no basis in fact or an exaggeration of reality. And I think many people, you don't have to be anybody with addiction to engage in this. You begin to think of reality in a certain way, and you're not really willing to have any flexibility in either your thoughts or behaviors, and you just continue to do the same things over and again. The third is experiential avoidance. One of the things that I know many of you are probably familiar with Brené Brown, but she talks about three psychological means of escape. And one is the one that we are talking about most of the time when we're dealing with addiction, which is numbing. But, of course, numbing can take on many, many different forms, whether it's drugs, alcohol, sex, gambling, OCD-type behaviors, those sorts of things, eating, not eating, cutting, all those sorts of things. So that's the numbing side of it. She also talks about two other things that I think are very interesting. One is perfectionism, and a lot of people, a lot of people's experiential avoidance is to be perfectionistic and attempt to control their environment, hoping then that they don't have to deal with the feelings that are associated with whatever drove them to the perfectionism. And the last escape mechanism that Brené Brown talks about is the escape mechanism of catastrophic thinking. That's the one where you're sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Even if you're having a good day, it can't be a good day because something bad's going to happen, and then bad things are going to start cascading from there. And your past experiences have basically shown you that that's the way life works. That also can obviously be a self-fulfilling prophecy, and so it's difficult for people to deal with that. In any case, all three of those types of escape mechanisms basically lead people into suffering. And then when you suffer, you start back over again with the cascade of escape. And we're going to talk about that specifically in a few minutes as well. If you go to the next slide, I have the slide on the amygdala. Again, many people are basically ruled by fear and flight, and they're never able to stop long enough to experience their feelings. They're basically in chronic fatigue from just the escape mechanisms that are going on. So when we're the next slide talks about treating trauma and dual diagnosis. So what happens to many and probably most individuals, that at least that I see in treatment, is a history of some type of maladaptive coping mechanisms that lead to unacceptable or painful feelings that demand to be avoided. And I have a whiteboard in my office, and it's been the same whiteboard for a long time because it's basically a lot of these things that I'm talking about here, and it pertains to most every patient that I see in some form or fashion. And at the top of the whiteboard, and again, I'm sorry I don't have a slide in the slide packet to show you my my board, but I'd be glad to take a picture of it and send it to you if you're interested. But at the top of the board is basically high expectations. This is the top of the board on the left, so picture that. There's high expectations either by the person themselves or by family members or by significant others or whatever. But almost everyone has these high expectations, and then because they aren't able to reach those the heights, then everything becomes sort of disappointing or a failure. And this becomes very acute with many individuals, and so they're constantly trying to get to reach the bar, but never making it to the bar. That is also coupled with a lot of people's trauma. So we have people that basically are somewhat traumatized by having high expectations that are unmet. But then, of course, we have a whole population of people who have real significant trauma. A lot of the patients that we take care of are either war veterans, young women and men who have been sexually and physically abused growing up, people who have gotten into gangs, been in all kinds of street violence, those sorts of things. In any case, what they talk about, or what, and again, back to Brené Brown, I'm going to use her quite a bit here because I think a lot of her things are basically very adaptable to this ACT framework. What she always talks about is that when young people are traumatized, they tend to associate their trauma, or they incorporate their trauma, as guilt and shame. And once the guilt and shame sets in, back to Brené Brown, she talks about the shame shields, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with her concept of that. But what she says is that if people are shamed and traumatized, they tend to, again, have three sorts of mechanisms to try to cope with their shame. And one is anger. The second is isolation. And the third is codependency. And if you talk long enough to the patients that I see, at least, those three mechanisms are almost always in operation in a big way. And then if the anger, isolation, and codependency are chronically used as shields from shame and guilt, then what happens is the person then invalidates themselves. And once they're invalidated, all feelings that are negative that come to them are then reframed within the shame and guilt mechanism, and then they have to escape those feelings. And so that's where the escape basically comes from. And then we've already talked about the three ways to escape, and then the suffering, and then that whole cycle going over and over and over again. And so so what do I do with all of this? This is where, again, I don't know how many of you got the handout, the Getting Unstuck in ACT, but I'd just like to refer to that if you have it. If you don't have it, I'll explain it to you verbally here. What I'd like for you to do, if you do have the packet, is to just turn to the very last page. And the very last page is part of what they call it's one form of what they call the ACT matrix. And that is that there's a big triangle in the middle of the page, and it talks about what's called psychological flexibility. And psychological flexibility is just sort of a psychological term or a fancy term for people basically being able to control their lives or being able to do with their lives what they choose to do rather than being pushed around either by drugs, alcohol, other people, circumstances, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what Stephen Hayes and Russ Harris talk about is that to be able to accomplish psychological flexibility, it's important for people to be able to do three things simultaneously. And one of those things is to open up, which they talk about being able to separate or unhook from thoughts and feelings. And the second is to be present, which goes along with all the things that we try to teach patients about mindfulness and those sorts of things. And then last but not least is the ability to do what matters, which is the whole concept of living a values-driven life. So how do I use all this stuff? Well, the way that I use it in day-to-day practice, for whatever, and again, like I said, I'm not doing research. I'm just basically taking care of patients, and so I'm certainly open to changing what I'm doing or any criticism that anybody might have out there. But the first thing, obviously, is to try to listen to people's stories and try to get where they're coming from with regard to that whiteboard that I was talking about, and just trying to find out how much trauma they've experienced, how much shame and guilt they go through, and that sort of thing. And then I try to reframe for all my addicted patients the fact that we're really not concentrating on their drug or alcohol use as much as we are concentrating on trying to help them not escape their feelings. And putting it in that context sort of takes the, stigma off of the addiction at least a little bit, because I think that a lot of people are defined by their drug of choice or defined by their lifestyle or whatever, and that gets reinforced a lot of times both in and out of treatment. So I try to take that and reframe the idea of what the escape means. The other thing that I try to do with a lot of the patients, if opportunity presents itself, is to do some sort of a three chair type empty chair exercise, some motion focused therapy, just right off the bat. And I'll set up the three chairs and ask and again, like I said, this is after I've spent time with them and that sort of thing. This is not the first thing that I'll do with anyone, but I'll say, you know, my name's Joe. So I'll say, Joe number one, you're sitting in chair number one. I want you to talk to Joe number two, and I would like for you to tell Joe number two all the crap you tell yourself about yourself and that sort of thing. And they're usually excellent at this part of the exercise. They can tell themselves how stupid they are, how bad they are, how messed up they are, how worthless they are, et cetera, et cetera. And this can go on for quite some time. So then after they've sort of burned out with being self-critical, I put them in chair number two so they physically move to the second chair, and I ask them to defend themselves. And a lot of times it's very interesting because their visage will change and their voice will change, and they'll begin to defend themselves with great vigor and talk about all the things that could or should have happened in their lives, why it's not happening, all the reasons for why it's not happening, et cetera, et cetera. And then I'll move them to the third chair, and then I'll ask them to speak some compassion to Joe number one and Joe number two. And I'll usually get one of two results. One result is that they really become speechless and don't really have much to say or don't know what to say to themselves. Or the second one, which is more common, is they begin to sort of sound like their father or mother and begin to give advice. And they basically tell their other two alter egos about what they should be doing, how they could be doing it, all those sorts of things. So I'll let that go on for a while, but then I'll try to stop them and just say, you know, does that really sound compassionate to you? And most of the time they get it, that it really doesn't. And I try to help them. It's sort of like the movie The Help. You know, I try to get them to say to themselves, you know, you're smart, handsome, and important, or smart, beautiful, and important. And just to see, let them try that on. And then I talk with them about the third chair being recovery and chair number one and chair number two more or less being their addiction. Because as long as they're sitting in chair number one and chair number two, there's the same stuff that we were talking about on the left side of the whiteboard, which had to do with self-recrimination, not being able to hit the bar, feeling a lot of shame and guilt, et cetera, et cetera. And that cascade beginning and not being able to end. Now, on the right-hand side of my whiteboard, which sort of brings me to the point of chair number three, is that at the top of the right-hand side of the whiteboard, which is solutions and using acceptance and commitment therapy, is the whole thing of self-validation and self-compassion. And as you can see with the three-chair exercise, most of my patients have no real working concept of self-compassion or self-validation. And many of them have spent their whole lives basically being put down, feeling bad about themselves, not really having a lot of positive feelings about themselves. In fact, the three-chair exercise, this is an aside which has nothing to do with this talk, is that if I get people in chair number one and they can't think of anything bad to say about themselves, that's almost diagnostic for narcissistic personality disorder. But anyway, that's 1% of the people that I take care of, I guess. But anyway, so back to the right-hand side of the whiteboard. So at the top of the whiteboard on the right-hand side talks about self-compassion and self-validation. And then the second thing underneath self-compassion and self-validation is the whole idea, which goes along with this acceptance and commitment stuff, is that if we can teach people how to accept feelings rather than escape feelings, then we might be able to get somewhere with getting them out of the compulsive, addictive sorts of things. And this is probably the hardest part. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the YouTube video called Demons on the Boat. I think that's a Steve Hayes, Russ Harris, little five-minute cartoon video. But I like to talk to my patients about that and show it to them. It's a little cartoon, and there's a guy on a ship, and every time he sets course and sets sail, all these demons come up out of the hull of the ship and start screaming at him and intimidating him. And when they do that, he lets go of the wheel, and the boat starts to sail around in circles. But if, as long as he's not holding on to the wheel, the demons go below decks, and so they don't really bother him. So he's left in this conundrum of not being able to do anything with his ship sailing around in circles, or he's holding on to the wheel of the ship with all these demons tormenting him. And he sees other boats going to shore, and that really ticks him off because he feels that, you know, he must be doing something wrong. And so finally he gets up to gumption and realizes that the demons can't hurt him. So he grabs the wheel, sets course, sets sail, and sure enough the demons come out. But what he does is he doesn't let go of the wheel. And one of the things that we're always trying to get our patients to do with this second step in the acceptance and commitment piece is to be able to do exposure therapy of some sort where they can begin to take their worst feelings, whether it's their anxiety, their shame, guilt, whatever it is, and begin to sit with it and start to make friends with it rather than to try to escape it. And the psychologist that taught me all this, he had the analogy of the beach balls. And again, many of you may be familiar with this, and this might be old hat. But he always tells the patient to pretend like they're in the middle of a swimming pool and to envision beach balls floating towards them as the wind pushes the beach balls towards them. And the beach balls are the worst feelings that they ever have. And what he tells them is that most of the time what we've learned in our lives is that when the beach balls get close enough and they're uncomfortable enough, we grab them and we push them under the water. So if you push a beach ball under the water, basically it's either going to come back up and hit you in the face, or you're going to be stuck holding the beach ball under the water. And patients seem to get this analogy pretty well, I think. What we're trying to get them to do is just hold the beach ball for a time and then let it go, but not put any energy into pushing the beach ball under the water or fighting with it or getting hit in the face with it or whatever. So that's our attempting to get people to into some type of exposure therapy to get people into some sort of acceptance phase. If we can move past the acceptance, then we can begin to get people to move towards their values. Now, if you have the Stephen Hayes handout, about halfway through the handout there is the bullseye, and I'd encourage you just to turn to that if you have it. If you don't, basically, it's the Tobias Lundgren bullseye worksheet. I don't know if you've ever seen that before, and if you have, again, I apologize to all of you who I'm boring. But the page before the bullseye is a list of like 37 things that people can potentially value, and they have to do with attributes such as honesty, encouragement, flexibility, friendliness, intimacy, etc. It also has things to do with material things like money, love. Industry, working hard, those kinds of things. And so it really doesn't matter, and we don't really care what people value. But what we ask them to do is to pick out maybe six or seven things that they value the most highly. And then you come to the bullseye, and you put all those things in the middle of the bullseye. And the bullseye is then in four quadrants. One quadrant is about relationships. One's about personal health and growth. Another is about work and education, and another is about leisure. Now, if all their values are in the center of the bullseye, what we ask them to do is say, well, how close to the bullseye are you in these four areas of your life? Now, for almost all of my patients that I see in inpatient drug and alcohol rehab, they're when they start making marks on the page, they're outside of the bullseye. They're not living where they want to be with relationships. They're not taking care of themselves. Their work and education is on hold. And leisure has basically been drugs or alcohol, so it's not really what they want to be doing. It's just what they're doing. So what we also do is at that point we say, well, what would it take for you to move an X from the outside of the bullseye towards what you value? And none of this stuff is rocket science. For relationships, generally speaking, it's really just staying in touch with family and friends, being honest, those sorts of things. And I get them to write that down and understand that it's not like we're not asking them to do something really major. We're just asking them to do one thing that would be different with regard to how they're relating. For a lot of people who never speak to their significant other when they're in their active addiction, you know, we talk about the whole thing of just sitting down with their significant other for a few minutes every day and just being honest or sharing a thought or something. With regard to personal growth and health, again, getting people to either go to meetings or to eat properly or get 8 hours of sleep a night, all these sorts of things. Again, it sounds like things that we would think about as being normal and rote, but it's not something that the patients that I take care of see as even a possibility sometimes. Now, a lot of the people that I take care of with regard to work and education, they're actually holding down jobs and that sort of thing, but when they're in their active addiction, they don't show up for work. And so the thing to move their ex towards the middle of the bullseye is just to show up. So, again, you're getting the idea about what we're talking about here. So the idea is that if you'll do some very simple things, it can move you towards your values. And on the right-hand side of my whiteboard, again, back to self-compassion and self-validation at the top, then accepting feelings rather than escaping feelings. And then the third thing is moving towards your values. And then the fourth thing is being happy. And we always talk about not being able to get to happy from the left-hand side of the board. So if you're doing the escape thing and doing that wheel of suffering, re-traumatization, self-invalidation, shame and guilt, numbing, suffering, that's basically the problem that all our patients are facing. And we're attempting to get them to what we talk about as hitting the reset button rather than the escape button. I don't know if you guys ever saw, I think it was Home Depot, you know, the easy button. All our patients basically tend to know how to hit the easy button, but hitting the reset button is a very difficult thing. So if I could get back with my handout, which I've skipped over some of the things, what I want you to understand is that where we're coming from with acceptance and commitment therapy with regard to addiction is that acceptance really, we believe, is kind of the basis for people attempting sobriety. One of the things that I have on my whiteboard is I have AA right in the center between the right-hand side of the board and the left-hand side of the board. And what I see frequently, again, is people get to sobriety, but they don't get to happiness because of their inability to be kind to themselves. And so that self-validation and self-compassion is so important for people once they get sober to be able to move past their suffering and white knuckling. So the thing that I would like to sort of end with is that I always tell groups that I talk to the Lion King story, and I never realized it until I started studying acceptance and commitment therapy, but the story of the Lion King is really acceptance and commitment therapy in a nutshell. Simba is a young lion who's supposed to, so there's high expectations put on him to be the Lion King. And, of course, Scar puts a monkey wrench in that by wanting to take over. But Scar sets up the stampede. Mufasa saves Simba from the stampede, but Simba doesn't really know that Scar pushed Mufasa off the cliff and killed him. And Simba comes along and finds his father dead, so he's traumatized. He comes out, Scar lies to him and exaggerates his guilt, and so Simba runs away. And so Simba makes it to another part of the jungle, and Timon and Pumbaa find him, and they do Hakuna Matata. And it dawned on me one day that Hakuna Matata really is drugs, alcohol, and other escape mechanisms. So even though they couldn't show it in the movie, Simba's doing dope and smoking weed out there in the jungle, he grows up to be a young lion, and his father appears to him in the sky and talks to him about taking over, and Simba basically goes and sits in chair number one in our empty chair exercise and declares himself to be unworthy.
And then his girlfriend comes along, and Nala shakes him into some reality and tries to get him to come back. And Simba goes to chair number two and makes excuses and defends himself. And then it's not until Rafiki comes along that he's attempting to get Simba to come back to the pride and take over his rightful place. And Simba's not having it, so Rafiki takes his stick and just whacks him in the head. And this is the whole movie. Simba says, why did you hit me in the head? And Rafiki just says, don't worry about it. It's in the past. And then he swings at him again, and Simba ducks. And Rafiki says, he says, you can either learn from the past or run from the past. So then Simba goes back, and he does what he needs to do, kicks all the hyenas out, and kills Scar, becomes the Lion King, takes over the pride. And when I talk to my patients about that, I always ask them if they would rather do Hakuna Matata or whether they want to be the Lion King. And the answer is universally the Lion King. And I really think that metaphor is, if you can't remember anything else about acceptance and commitment therapy, I think that's the metaphor for this whole type of therapy. We're just attempting to get people to stop running and to basically be able to come into some type of an acceptance of their feelings so that they can move forward with their lives, live their values, and be happy. So that's all I got. I don't know if any of you have any thoughts or questions or comments, but I'm more than happy to talk with you.
Hi, Joe?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Hi, it's Mark.
Hi.
Well, first of all, thank you so much. That was really, it gave me a real sense of the ACT paradigm, which I was saying earlier, I've always struggled around with it.
Yeah.
My question is a little more philosophical, which is that I see the value in doing all this stuff, but to me, I go back and forth between, on the one hand, I know that there's a huge correlation of trauma with addiction.
Yes.
On the other hand, I see so many people who sober up and they seem to be pretty well adjusted. And so I sometimes wonder how much the emotional dysregulation is a core feature of addiction or is just something that may be secondary to, the loss of control of the addiction. I tend to see the loss of control as being more a brain chemistry dysfunction.
I don't want to minimize the brain chemistry piece. once an addict, always an addict in terms of the dopamine dysregulation. So I don't want to minimize that. I also don't want to minimize like the use of medication-assisted treatment. Like we use a lot of Suboxone for people who are opiate addicted and that sort of thing. What I'm trying to say with what I'm saying today is that we're trying to take as much stuff off the table for people with addiction as possible so that they can basically move towards their values rather than be stuck in whether it's their cravings, which the MAT stuff is helpful for. And again, that's another whole lecture and another whole hour. But the idea is to try to remove obstacles, and I don't know if that's answering your question or not. But I don't want to oversimplify. I don't want to make everybody think, well, we just use ACT and everybody have a nice day. Mm-hmm. It's obviously much more complicated than that.
Oh yeah, and I'm not saying one is more important than the other. I'm just for me, I have trouble seeing the connection between the brain chemistry piece and the ACT piece. In my mind, I keep going back and forth as to what that connecting variable is.
Well, I really think it's the fear and the anxiety, personally. Like I said, if you could be a fly on the wall in my office, the thing that almost everybody comes in with is this emotional dysregulation thing, and they're looking for either a medicine or something to fix it. And the thing that's really hard about talking to people about this is we're getting people to try to think in a completely different sort of paradigm about, again, making friends with their anxiety rather than feeling like they have to take a pill to quell it, which is only reinforcing the idea of having to use a substance to make yourself feel better. And that's really tough in the addiction field, because there's plenty of people out there who, you know, either have given up on what I'm talking about, or believe that there's a prescription for every ill.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the cartoon I have that shows the analyst saying, I've determined that you have an addictive personality, and the patient saying, oh, my God, what do I take for that?
Right, exactly. Perfect. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
This is Christina, and I just wanted to really thank you for sharing, explaining things, and actually how ACT is implemented, and I find it very I have a couple of two questions.
Sure.
The first is, I agree that for a lot of people in recovery, kind of realizing how strong their emotions are, or that emotions actually are behind the reasons for relapsing or lapsing.
Yes.
I think that focus or accepting the intensity of those emotions can be very scary and a big part of recovery. I also agree that kind of lining up those values or feelings with values can be useful, because I do training in MI, and one of the things that we do for helping people to realize that their values are threatened is to talk about what are the values that you, like, are important to you, and then I ask them, you know, what values are you living by now?
Exactly.
So I find that what's useful for them is to figure out whether or not they are the same, and then we talk about why they're not the same or what would they like to see. So I understand.
Yeah, so you're developing the discrepancy thing.
Yeah, well, the people who participate actually see it in front of their eyes, and
yeah.
It helps them to articulate it for themselves. So I understand those are both pretty important components, feelings and values. I just feel like, how do you connect the two clinically? Because to me it seems that a lot of people who are in recovery will stay at that feeling point. Like the values seems more aspirational or abstract, you know?
Well, and if I could go ahead and butt in, that's where that Lundgren values exercise I think is important, because I think it's important to operationalize what actually acting out on their values looks like. I think if they see like making changes as being almost like impossible rather than some fairly simple thing, like I said, showing up for work or whatever, or calling your significant other, or writing a letter to your children, if they could just begin to understand that their values can be operationalized rather simply, I think that's really important. Now, like I said, I don't have a lot of research data to back that up. I'm just telling you what I think.
That's useful. I mean, so then the person, you can start a conversation about what you did that reflects these values that day, and how are you feeling that day?
Yes. And see, there's another article that you can look up on the internet. It's another Russ Harris paper, I think, or a Stephen Hayes paper, but it's called Embracing Your Demons. But it's the same sort of idea that, in other words, unless people see again, the big thing that I wanted to get across today is that I believe we underutilize exposure type therapies. And that we're really geared, and I think the medical system, speaking as a doctor here, is geared towards trying to medicate people into some sort of a better feeling state, rather than challenging people to embrace whatever feelings there are that come to them. And it's really hard, but I think ultimately that's what's going to give people the best bang for their buck in the long run, if you can get them to that place.
I agree.
Dr. Tronchelli,
Yes.
This is Anne from Lancaster.
Hi.
And I hi. I know mindfulness is a part of the ACT approach, and
yes,
I'm wondering where the relaxation and centering practices mm-hmm. may fit in to help people get on the side of their vagus, which brings more opening.
Well, again, we just to tell you what we're doing locally is just that part of the treatment is their meditation groups and mindfulness groups and drumming and all those sorts of things. If you look at that last, do you have the handout that Mark sent out?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so anyways, so if you look at that last page again, the being present part, the meditation part, and the mindfulness or prayer or whatever works for people to keep them in the moment is one-third of the whole ACT matrix. So we believe that that's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always attempting to get people to do mindfulness sorts of things or to get in the present.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, we've got a few more minutes if people have questions.
Hi there. My name is Katrina Kessler, and I'm so sorry. I just got on the call a few minutes ago. I wasn't able to join earlier. But I just love what I'm hearing so far. And I was wondering, when you do the training or the sensitizing, whatever you want to call it, to help people stay in the present and I guess become familiar with their emotions and the intensity of them and learn how to withstand that, do you consider, is this done like in a particular context where, and then also a second question, is the idea based on them learning skills, like developing the capacity to withstand those emotions when they come
up? Actually, the psychologist that taught me what I learned about acceptance and commitment therapy does exposure therapy as part of a number of our patients' treatment. And so that is part of, especially for the people who are most dysregulated and people who are suffering from either trauma or PTSD type sorts of things. And so just to say this, there obviously there are some people who can only do these sorts of things in a therapeutic milieu. But there are plenty of people who can do what we jokingly call duct tape therapy, where you duct tape your mouth and you duct tape yourself to the chair and you just feel your feelings and you don't react to it. And actually that article that I was telling you about, Embracing Your Demons, he talks about an exercise that you can teach people to do where they basically try to make themselves into kind of a surveillance camera. And they can either sit in a room by themselves and just think about situations, or they can actually put themselves into situations that would normally be stressful. And what you basically are doing is you're asking them to be on kind of an interaction blackout so that they can just feel what's going on around them without the pressure of having to do anything about it.
Yeah,
And so and if people can begin to do those types of things, even for short periods of time, what they'll find out is they actually live through the experience. And that it's probably not as stressful as they imagined it was going to be to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, like I said, I'm sure there's a million ways of doing it. I don't claim to be the expert on exposure therapy, but I believe that it's really important as a concept.
So, so the context is recognized as being an important element to helping them develop that capacity, right?
Yes, and again, different people can do it at different speeds and in different ways.
Do you have any experience or knowledge about how that would look outside, taking people outside to do? Does that help facilitate that?
You mean in terms of outside of outside.
You know,
of,
like maybe take them into
treatment.
A forest. Like
oh,
take
yeah.
Every, take
yeah,
everybody
yeah.
out to into a forest, and you know, there's this exercise.
Well, I think tons of people do that without knowing that's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, allowing people to feel their feelings without having to react or being able to react, and understanding that they're still safe is a huge
right.
exercise.
And learning that however they feel is actually okay instead of,
yes.
I mean, society teaches people they're not supposed to feel certain things and these other emotions are good and you can feel those, but these others you can't feel. So kind of just letting all that fall away so that they can learn, you know, however you actually feel is quite all right and there's no judgment.
Exactly.
I imagine that's part of the process.
It is. And like I said, I don't know if you were in on the call when we were talking about that little YouTube video, Demons on the Boat.
Oh, no. Sorry, I missed that. Demons
that's
on
okay.
the Boat.
But
I'll
anyway, but look it up. It's a little five-minute video. And I think everybody should watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great little five-minute video.
Okay.
But it's all about what you just talked about.
Oh, okay. It's so good to hear that people are doing this work. Just to give a little context, I'm a doctoral student. I'm about to finish up my PhD at the end of the year. And
congratulations.
Thank you. I'd like to create a new kind of addiction treatment program that it focuses on grief and remorse and anxiety and emptiness, those things that the medical approach tends to not be so good at.
Gotcha.
And
well,
stay
in touch. I'll be glad to talk with you or help you in any way I could.
Oh, thank you so much. I will. I'll send you a little email and introduce myself.
Great.
Thanks for that offer.
You're welcome.
Hey, guys, I think we have time for maybe one more question. Anybody out there going once? Okay.
That's great. Well,
well
Mark, thank you very much.
And thank you for helping out. And I just want to make a quick announcement. Our next two calls are tentatively at this point. November 9th, Jeff Foote from the Center for Motivation and Change will be talking about the treatment of trauma in residential settings. And on December 14th, Catherine McHugh from McLean Hospital, Harvard Medical School, will be talking about treatment of opiates. We're waiting to finalize those two. But again, Joe Troncalli, thank you so much for helping us out and for giving us a real good insight into the act.
My pleasure. It's good talking to you too.
Thank you, Dr. Troncalli.
Thanks so much.
Bye
bye now.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
doing things and to take care of something. It's so much. Just take a mind. It's like, it's way around where I am. I don't know what to do.
Temple officials is the university police for dealing with complaints about walking. Report client made from the third card that on this Saturday, December, the day is coming today by about 65% of the United States.
Collecting the images right now while Matt decides to work out the problem.
we are optimistic that if they're going to figure it out, they're going to either get together proposing or figure out a workaround for a way to position it. In the meantime, can I expect it to continue working into the 2020s and overlap with its replacement, the James Webb Space Telescope? But what's interesting is that the big problem is that it was designed to be fixed during shuttle missions, and we don't have a shuttle program anymore, so we're kind of running out of ways to fix the Hubble. It does have an expiration date.
Fox, it's a 10-year-old fox, they're cute, they're adorable looking, and the island fox it doesn't have it in their DNA to be on the alert for the golden eagle. So the golden eagles basically started pinching on them, pushed them to the point of extinction. So you have this whole chain reaction. Biologists look at this and say, okay, we need to grab what island foxes we have left. We need to bring them in for a captive feeding program to try to save them. And so you have this whole cascade of events. And so the biologists had to figure out how these things were interrelated, and they started to fix them.
And I think so what really they started to fix. So what happened was they finally got enough of the bald eagles that they were able to reintroduce them to the islands. Then the golden eagles are going to get them. Tapping program, they relocated them to another part of California and into Nevada as well. And then the island foxes had gotten to the point where they could re-release them onto the islands. And they've just been growing. Now, it's incredible. He's a National Park Service biologist. I've talked to him for 20 years about this project. He said maybe in our lifetime we could see the island fox recover. It happened in less than 20 years.
Wow.
It's remarkable. Biologists around the world are dealing with this because humans worry that this fixes the problem.
But wait, there's more. There is more because there's other non-native things out there. There's eucalyptus trees and there's ants. Specifically, Arctic ants that
can find on the island. They went on and they said, okay, we're going to dust for these ants. We're going to get rid of these ants. But the problem is, how do you know that you've gotten rid of all the ants?
the residential.
I'm comfortable. Yeah, I'm too.
all of our book reading on a exam, there were all the questions that go over our book reading are worth half a point, and then chapter one are worth a full point. So that way, you can get examples and answer questions in class, but the reading, but the book reading, not as much.
Wow.
Which will address the important stuff in class, but.
One of the things that sounds to me is it's a website that we're talking to the first thing that's wrong, not the same thing that's wrong, but you can also get in the three types of home options because you downloaded it, etc. But you can do like community conversations, there's a similar. And really kind of get used to stuff online and get interviews and so on. So it's kind of a really easy way and for us to do that. And but also you can get more customers out there, you know, online and I
think of that, you know. But it's pretty encouraging that you can do that. That's what you can do that.
So this is I have particularly, oh my goodness, what's going on?